Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Jane McGonigal. Jane is a game designer who believes that playing games and having a gameful mindset can help improve our health, relationships, overall outlook, and her new book, Super Better, explains how. This episode, we talk about Super Better and how it works. We talk about not judging games by their content, but by how they're played, which is a fascinating concept. We talk about cooperative games versus competitive games, the intersection of games and therapy, and a lot more. It's a good episode, and Jane was great, but looking back, I feel like it could have come a bit deeper. I think I cared a bit more about whether she liked me or not than I did about having a deeply challenging conversations. And I think this is a bit of a reoccurring thing with me. I think the challenge for me is to, you know, I want to be respectful of someone's life and work, but I also, you know, really want to challenge it if there are certain elements that I disagree with. And I think I need to view it as giving the author the opportunity to provide more nuance by challenging their work. And that's something I want to check. That said, as someone who doesn't play games, talking to Jane and reading Super Better is fascinating and is an intellectual exercise in and of itself. So definitely worth checking out. Here's Jane. I've been really fascinated to talk with you for a couple of reasons. One is because, you know, Ben Horowitz recently, you know, The Hard Thing About Hard Things came out last year. And one of the biggest takeaways was that it's very important for a founder and our audience to manage their own psychology. So I'm really curious about what we can learn from adopting a gameful mindset. But before then, can you give a brief background around Super Better and why this book and why now?
Sure. Well, I've been researching the psychology of games for 15 years. I was actually the first person in the world to get a PhD studying the topic of how games change how we think and act when we're tackling real life problems. And it is just time for everybody to understand how the games that they play can actually help them develop really important psychological resources. We have 1.23 billion people on this planet who spend on average an hour a day playing video games. So it would be a really huge wasted opportunity if people don't understand how they can use games to better themselves.
One thing you also talk about in the book, the gameful mindset, of course, goes way beyond games. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Well, most people, when they play a game, and it can be a video game or a sport or a board game or card game, most people, when they play games, they adopt a certain way of thinking and approaching challenge and stress that is extremely effective and extremely beneficial. We're more optimistic, we're more determined and resilient in the face of setbacks. We find it easier to ask other people for help or to team up with them on a mission. We learn faster from our mistakes. And there are all these really wonderful things that happen that we do naturally when we play games. But most people in their everyday lives do not adopt the same mindset when they're tackling a tough obstacle. And so what the Super Better method and the research I've been doing for the past 5 years is all about is how do we bring that same gameful mindset so that we are as creative, as determined, as self-motivated, optimistic, you know, better able to learn, connecting with others when we have really tough challenges in our own lives. And of course, it came out of my wanting to be more like a game player in my own life when I suffered a traumatic brain injury. That was sort of the genesis of this method, me trying to apply everything I'd done in the past decade of research to my own personal challenge.
And, you know, it's interesting because the startup story is so, you know, ridden with failure is just built into the game, you know, so extreme highs, extreme lows, and bouncing back from that. And so, you know, you write about how you experience, instead of, you know, PTSD, post-traumatic growth and post-ecstatic growth. Talk a little bit about, you know, what separates people who go through post-traumatic growth and PTSD and what people can learn from that.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a really interesting phenomenon, post-traumatic growth. There is a subset of people who suffer some kind of very traumatic event. It could be a psychological event, it could be injury, illness, could be losing your job or having to shut down your company. Some people come out of that reporting that they feel stronger, braver, happier, better understood by their friends and family, better able to commit their time and energy to their top priorities and really better able to lead a life free of regret. Not everybody comes out of traumatic experiences that way. Some people get stuck in a more of a post-traumatic stress disorder phenomenon where they feel haunted what they went through, where they feel, you know, less brave or more depressed, more anxious. And in my own experience of going through the traumatic brain injury and coming out stronger and happier and, you know, better able to live my life the way I wanted to on the other side, I really wanted to dig into the scientific literature of post-traumatic growth and find out why. And that was actually, you know, a big aha moment in my life, because I realized if you study, I read hundreds of scientific articles on post-traumatic growth. And when you drill down into what they say will make the difference between just having a traumatic response and actually coming out stronger, they are all things that we do when we play games. Things like adopting a challenge mindset instead of a threat mindset, having the ability to recruit other people to participate in our process, you know, just like we would invite someone to play a game with us, focusing on everything that we can do, every little thing we can do to get stronger or happier, just the way you would collect power-ups in a game, always sort of scanning the environment for things that will make you stronger. All these things we naturally do when we play games, and especially video games, turn out to be the key to post-traumatic growth. So I decided to create my own game. You know, it's a web game, an app, and to help people use all of the techniques that they use in games in their real lives, particularly if they're going through a major challenge, like an illness or an injury or some kind of a personal setback.
And it's interesting, you know, a lot of people for some reason have a certain guilt with, you know, having so much fun playing a game. Where does this guilt come from?
Well, of course, I mean, we live in a society where productivity is king, and we're told that playing games is a waste of time. But, you know, one of the truest things I think anybody ever said about gameplay was by a psychologist named Brian Sutton Smith. He wrote, you know, 30 years ago, the opposite of play isn't work, it's depression.
Yeah.
Right. Because when we play games, it's actually, we're working very hard. I mean, you can look at brain scans of gamers and see that their brains are extremely activated. You can just tell from body posture and how intensely we're engaged. So it's not that work and play are opposites. It's actually that the emotional and physiological state of play, you know, being energized, having self-confidence, having access to powerful, positive emotions, being optimistic about our own capabilities, that's the state of gameplay. And the opposite of that, you know, feeling pessimistic about our own capabilities, not having self-confidence, feeling a lack of physical energy and mental energy to engage with even ordinary tasks, let alone difficult tasks, all of the clinical symptoms of depression, they're literally the opposite of the gameful mindset. And so I think it's important people start to realize that playing games actually activates ways of thinking, activates neural networks that will give you the emotional resilience and mental resilience that you need in the rest of your life. It's not a waste of time. It's actually an investment.
And it's interesting, you know, I grew up playing a ton of games and then stopping all of a sudden, thinking that, you know, I was moving on to, I don't know, books or things, quote unquote, better things. And then you know, I'm reading your book and I'm feeling better about my childhood, but then I read the part where it says, you know, there are some games that are sometimes have negative experiences, and it's largely when you're playing with strangers online. And then I felt, oh, I was playing with a lot of strangers online.
No. Well, strangers online is totally fine. It's a very specific context. It's an aggressive themed game, so something like Call of Duty, against strangers, so competitively, not playing cooperatively with them. Playing against strangers online in an aggressive themed game can have negative impacts. The negative impact being it increases your testosterone in ways that make you more of a jerk for most people in everyday life. Less empathy towards others, more sort of hostile in your interactions with people. But that's only, I mean, you can play against strangers. You can play as long as it's not a very testosterone boosting game environment. But, you know, there, I would say use games for your own life effectively and strategically, you may want a testosterone boost one day. Maybe you need a lot of self-confidence and you want to be really aggressive in negotiations with a VC. I mean, go play some, you know, Call of Duty against strangers online and get yourself into that hostile mindset if that's how you want to be. I mean, that's, you know, you should use games strategically. And there are certainly circumstances in which having a shot of testosterone could help you. If you do it every day, people will think you're a jerk, and that's, you may not want that.
Right. No, it's interesting. Even just for exercising, for basketball has been my game, you know, growing up. And if you just put me on a track and just told me to exercise and work out, I don't really have this motivation. But for basketball, the desire to win and to destroy the opponent gets me, you know, a much better workout. And so I could see how this competitive gamified element, you know, super increases that. But I'm also a bit worried that sometimes I just get too aggressive and win at all costs. And sometimes, you know, even if I have to, you know, play dirty or you know, not play super dirty, but you know what I'm trying to say.
I do. That makes me think that you should play like Pandemic with some, like the cooperative board game Pandemic, and try to calm down a little bit and focus on a little bit of co-op. Because I mean, honestly, if this is a business podcast, I mean, you may want to be a win at all costs competitive type persona if you think that's advantageous. Although it does not bring the most mental health benefits as having more of a balance. So I would say if you feel that way, pull out a nice Pandemic game and do some co-op, try to save the world together for an hour or two. And that might give you a more of a kind of a balance of social resilience in addition to all of the mental resilience.
Yeah, this idea of co-op games is interesting. What are some other examples that come to mind?
You can build something together in Minecraft. That's a great co-op activity. You could play Plants vs. Zombies. One of my favorite games is Portal 2, to play that co-op with my husband. Even just sending people bonuses and, you know, social games like Candy Crush Saga is a nice way to build your social resilience, because it reminds people of their connection to you, and it shows that you are, you know, giving them a little boost. And when you ask them for a favor, they're going to be, even if it's subconsciously primed, think of you as an ally that will be to your benefit. Which, by the way, all of this is based in study. This is why Super Better is like a really fat book. It's because there are more than 1,000 peer-reviewed scientific studies that's in this book. And every you know, piece of advice that I give, it's based on multiple studies, you know, multiple rounds of validation, not just some, you know, one-off tiny study, and a lot of meta-analysis where you'll look at hundreds of studies in one study. So all of these seemingly, you know, the kind of strange tips and pieces of advice, it's all grounded in the research literature.
And that's why you said it took, you know, 5 years or over 5 years after your accident to publish this book?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing I focused on was building the app and the website so that we could see other people use this method, collect data from them. So, you know, the book is informed from collecting data from just under 500,000 people who were using the Super Better method for challenges in their own life. We also, did studies, a clinical trial funded by the NIH with Ohio State University Medical Research Center. We did a big randomized control study with the University of Pennsylvania. I didn't want to publish this book until I knew I could back up the ideas with both data from users and really rigorous scientific studies. So, you know, it takes about 5 years to do that.
Yeah. And you're also, you know, you're very grounded in research, and you're also at the Institute of the Future. Can you talk a little bit about your work there and how it relates to your work in games?
The Institute for the Future is in Palo Alto, California. For people who don't know our work, you can go online to iftf.org and download almost an infinite amount of research about the future, really vivid scenarios and forecasts about the future of society and technology and government, and really imaginative ideas. And it's a nonprofit. I've been working there for about 8 years, and I've had the opportunity to make a lot of games with them, games that invite people to think about the future and even simulate the future in their own lives so they can get a sense of how they would respond to different scenarios. It's really interesting right now. one of the biggest future forecasting games that I helped create, it was called Superstruct. We ran it in 2008. And so many of the scenarios that were a part of that game that people practiced living through are unfolding. I mean, we had a whole thing about drones and policies around drones and flying drones over private property, which is now in California just this week. They're trying to make that illegal. We were gaming that scenario in 2008. We had a whole scenario called Generation Exile about mass migration due to refugee status and how other countries would cope with that. And of course, what's going on in Europe right now is a perfect example of that. So what is beneficial about playing these games is people really have a chance to immerse themselves in these scenario spaces and develop a relationship with the idea so that, you know, you'll find yourself tracking them for years and years. And so you're more informed, you're more engaged, you're more likely to participate in public discourse about it, in voting about it, and maybe innovating. You know, we've had people play our games and create startup companies based on what they saw in our forecast. So it's not really related to Super Better, except for, you know, we know that when you play games, we're more optimistic and more creative. And so obviously we want to bring those strengths to thinking about the future.
Yeah. Going back to the perception of it, you know, I'll make a comparison to hip hop for a second. Some people will hear a negative song on the radio and think the whole genre is bad for you. And someone was put CGTA or Call of Duty and cast a whole shadow over something that is obviously a huge industry and, you know, millions of people love.
Yeah. But Eric, you should look at Call of Duty and think, wow, that's awesome. Because in all these peer reviewed studies, we've shown that people actually feel more compassion and empathy for somebody they're playing with as long as they're playing in the same room. Let's all play, you know, Call of Duty, like, you know, with somebody we know and sit next to them and play. Or, you know, Call of Duty has been shown to improve your ability to track multiple streams of information simultaneously to make better decisions faster. I mean, that's the thing. People always want to divide games into good games and bad games based on their content, which is the stupidest thing you can do when it comes to games, because in reality, what differentiates games are their mechanics, the rules, the obstacles, the style of play. I mean, content is the most useless thing you could look at. So we don't, you know, if I were to look at a bad game, I'd be looking at Monopoly, because as far as game design goes, there are basically no benefits to playing Monopoly, and it's a terrible game. And if, so that's my example of a negative hip hop song is Monopoly. If you look at that game, you would think games have no benefits.
Is Grand Theft Auto a misunderstood?
Yeah, I mean, look, Grand Theft Auto, it's an amazing open world game. It provokes almost universally in players feeling of curiosity and awe as you discover and explore this vast environment. Those are extremely positive emotions that have benefits that linger far after you're playing. And so you have to really look at how the game makes you feel and what skills or abilities it develops. And, you know, having more curiosity, having that instinct to explore is a great thing. I mean, particularly for people hoping to be innovators.
Yeah. And I heard one criticism that was like, why do people criticize these content in hip hop or games, but not in movies or books, or, you know, they're thrillers, but, you know, you don't see people imitating the things they see on thrillers.
Oh no. I mean, if you look at the best-selling books, they're full of horrible serial killers and mass violence. And, but you're reading, so it's good for you. I mean, it's really the content, again, it's consuming content is like the least interesting aspect of games. It's really about the design of the obstacles or the challenges, the stress that you're putting yourself under when you play. Because every game, you're stressing yourself out on purpose, trying to do something that is designed to intentionally be difficult and challenging for you. And so, I don't know, I can't wait until we stop having conversations about the content in games and focus more on how they're provoking our engagement with challenges and stress. And
the content, you know, versus mechanics or focusing on mechanics rather than content is a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of previously. I'm curious, my broader question bringing that up is, what do you think needs to be true for for people to stop, for us to stop having this conversation, essentially, for people to realize, okay, there's a ton of research, obviously, showing that games, reduce anxiety, increase, attention, people pay attention more, make us happier in myriad of ways. What do you think needs, is there a rebranding? Is there, what needs to happen?
By the way, Eric, I have to ask you, did you like steal a car? Are you playing Grand Theft Auto right now? Because I hear, I hear the sirens coming for you.
Oh, no, there's an ambulance in the background.
Oh, no. Okay.
I'm caught red-handed.
So, I mean, two things need to happen. One, obviously, everybody who reads my book will be transformed forever, and that would be great. But really, people just need to try this in their own lives. They need to experiment and practice. So, you know, the book is full of things you can try, really strategic ways of using certain games. This game will help reduce anxiety and, you know, even block a panic attack. This kind of game has been shown to have the same benefits of meditation. This kind of game can help prevent post-traumatic stress disorder. This kind of game will make people more likely to do you favors in real life if you play it with them. Just start experimenting. And I'll tell you, people who try these techniques are transformed and become evangelists for it. So I just think people who are interested should experiment in their own lives. Games are either free or insanely inexpensive, and there are no side effects. So it's a really fun and low stakes way to experiment with your own life.
And one of the most interesting anecdotes is you were talking to this, is it a Buddhist guru?
Well, it was a monk. I mean, who was living at a monastery in
tell the story.
Yeah, so I went on a silent retreat at a Buddhist monastery in some mountains in South Korea, and most of the weekend was silent, but we had an opportunity to have a kind of one-on-one meeting with the monk who had led the retreat. His name was Vasily, and if we had any questions. And I wanted to ask about game playing because I knew that the Buddha was famously against playing games. He had this whole list of games you shouldn't play, like dice games. And you I guess a very popular game in the Buddha's time was having somebody trace letters on your back and you would have to try to guess the letter they were tracing. I think I remember playing that in elementary school. He said, do not play that game. Never. Buddhists will not play. And so I wanted to kind of ask him about that and talk about, you know, the research that shows that playing games is this incredible way to learn to control your attention. That's what the first chapter in the book is about, all the ways that you can control your attention through gameplay in order to improve your mental resilience. And so I thought maybe the monk will be interested to hear about the research and we could talk about it. And then I got this big lecture about, well, you shouldn't play games and the Buddha was against it. And because playing games is a way to escape reality and you're blocking out reality and you should never escape reality. That's anathema to Buddhist principles. But then he got all sheepish looking and, you know, admitted, well, I play Angry Birds every night. And he actually admitted that after another monk was sitting next to him and started elbowing him. But that's not in the book. But he was actually provoked by his fellow monk to confess that he played Angry Birds every night. And we talked about it and he said, you know, we can only meditate for so many hours of a day. And that he did feel like it was a way to focus his thoughts. And there in Buddhism, there are all kinds of thoughts that you would like to dismiss, really unhelpful thoughts, whether you're, you know, thinking negatively about yourself or other people. And so gameplay is a way to not be having those thoughts in the moment and really learn to focus your attention on the thing that you want to focus on. So that was amazing. After I got this big lecture about don't play games, except yes, I'm a Buddhist monk and I play Angry Birds every night as part of my formal practice.
Have you seen, or what's the intersection between, you know, therapy and a gameful mindset? Or have therapists been very, very receptive or?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I hear from people all the time who both, I mean, doctors and therapists are prescribing super better for everything from pain management to, you know, social anxiety and depression. And I mean, it makes sense because when I invented it, although I had a traumatic brain injury and I had all of these cognitive symptoms like, you know, difficulty thinking and concentrating and headaches and nausea. And I mean, this is for a year I was dealing with these symptoms. The thing that was really bothering me was the incredible depression and anxiety and even suicidal thoughts that I was having, which I later learn happens to 1 in 3 people who even just have a concussion. 1 in 3 will go on to have suicidal thoughts because of the brain chemistry changes that happen while your brain is trying to heal. That was what really I was trying to grapple with. So the fact that I invented this little game that I played with myself that I first called Jane the Concussion Slayer and later became Super Better, that it makes sense that it would be so effective for treating depression and anxiety, because that was really what I was grappling with. When I saw that Super Better was working so effectively for so many people, I mean, I went and read thousands of scientific papers trying to see the parallels between the gameful mindset and things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been proven very effective for depression and anxiety. And I mean, it's just a lot of things that smart people have in common, whether it's, you know, Buddhist monks or cognitive behavioral therapists or game designers. A lot of people have hit on the same principles of what it takes to really have a strong, you know, mental and emotional balance. I was not surprised to find out that a lot of things that game designers do to get you to be engaged and optimistic and determined and resilient are the same kinds of things that cognitive behavioral therapists will have you do, like coming up with multiple strategies to battle bad guys, you know, in your realities. Like when you play a game, you would never just try one strategy over and over again and keep failing. You're always willing to try a different strategy. That's what you do. Let me try it this way. I'll try it this way. But in real life, we tend to get stuck on one strategy and we just keep trying the same thing over and over again. We're not as willing to experiment with how we approach problems. And cognitive behavioral therapists and game designers would, you know, encourage you to have a kind of psychological flexibility to approach problems with multiple strategies. Even if you think they won't work, you give it a try because you never know. That's how you feel when you play games, is how you should feel when you try in real life.
And one thing you've also done with Super Better is you've built kind of a community of people, you know, all over who believe in these principles, who are, you know, doing it in their own practice. A lot of people in our audience are trying to build communities. What can they learn from how you've built, you know, community around your work?
Well, we had a really interesting experience, something that we did not build into the app or website that, you know, we're now working on developing for future versions, which is allowing the players and the community to really teach each other. Originally, we designed Super Better so that you could invite people that you know, whether you're Facebook friends with them, you have your email address, to play with you and to see your secret headquarters. And we wanted to keep the social environment pretty limited because people are playing for really serious things like depression or, you know, cancer, or people are even, you know, weight loss. They may not want everybody in their lives to know what's going on with that. And it turned out that quite a lot of the players were much more kind of extroverted and sociable about wanting to tackle these challenges and, you know, wanting to share, here are my power-ups that I've collected for trying to lose weight. Here are the bad guys that I'm battling as I'm starting a company and all the strategies I've come up with for battling them. People started making wikis to publish their own, you know, content for the game. And I guess, you know, that just goes to show what a bias or prejudice that so many of us have about vulnerability, you know, because I just assumed people would not be willing to be so vulnerable, but in fact, they are.
Yeah, no, definitely. And let's talk more about what startups can learn from Super Better and your work. And you're in, you know, San Francisco, so you know, I'm sure you hear all the time this buzzword gamification. That I don't even know, you know, is used so much, we don't even know what it means right now. I mean, it's such a broad topic, but talk a little bit about how, you know, when you work with startups or when you advise startups, how they should think about it and what are common, you know, mistakes they make when they do think about it.
Well, I have to say the gamification principles that most people are familiar with are not design elements that I use in my own work or that I advise people to use. I mean, the early wave of gamification, it was really all about a philosophy of motivating people through reward systems that look like the reward structures or advancement structures of many video games, like points and levels and achievement badges and leaderboards. But I mean, I've always tried to, you know, tell people that this is not an effective way to bring a gameful aspect to what you're creating, because if you ask people, I mean, we'll just do an experiment here. You know, Eric, tell me, what's a game that you really have loved in your life? It could be now, it could be when you were a kid, just any game that you really loved.
Can I say basketball, or should it be a console game?
No, you can be basketball.
Okay, basketball.
So tell me a few things you love about basketball.
It helps me improve myself consistently physically. It's a test every time I step on the court. It's a new start. I can improve and get better, and I enjoy winning.
Okay, great. So at no point did you mention, you know, I like it when I get 2 points for scoring a basket, right? Which would be like the point structure of the game. You're not saying things about, you know, I keep track of, you know, how many points I score. And I know I've scored 1,000 points this summer versus my friend who only scored 800. So I feel more powerful than I mean. When you actually talk to people what they like about games, you really come to understand the psychology aspects are nothing like what traditional gamification looks at. And so, you know, the first thing I heard you say was about the opportunity to get better, right? And obviously, I think that's the core psychology of games. That's why my book is called Super Better, because the fundamental experience of playing any game is getting better at it. Every game is designed for us to be bad at it the first time we play. It's why level one is easy. It's why games get harder as we go. You're constantly learning, having to acquire new skills, build your resources, get better. And so that experience of mastery and improvement, you know, when I talk to people who want to gamify something, I will talk to them about that fundamental psychology. And it's not that you're trying to manipulate people into doing things by giving them rewards. It's about creating real opportunities for self-improvement, real opportunities for mastery and acquisition of new skills and abilities. You know, just on a kind of related example, I was invited to make a game for the New York Public Library a few years ago. And, you know, at first they were thinking about traditional gamification elements, like you'll get points for checking out books and you'll get achievement badges for visiting different collections. And I was like, no way, because the only thing that does is it tries to motivate people to do what the library wants them to do. So I decided to research, you know, they particularly wanted to reach people under 35. I decided to research, what do people under 35 want to do that has to do with libraries? And it turns out that 91% of young people in the United States say they would like to write a book someday. They feel like they have a voice that's worth being heard or a story that's worth telling. So I decided to create a game for the library where if you play the game, you have actually written a book, which you can print on demand, which will be stored in the physical collection of the main, you know, beautiful Schwarzman branch of the New York Public Library, and you will be listed as a published author in their catalog. And I designed that game because that is that feeling of achieving something meaningful, you're powering up your skills, you're becoming an author overnight. That's my idea of gamification, is actually tapping into that psychology of helping people achieve extraordinary things and really get better at something that they care about.
That's interesting. The idea, you know, chasing badges for the sake of chasing badges doesn't really inspire us, but putting our stamp on something, you know, a book overnight, that's a fascinating concept.
And you've achieved a real goal that right. matters to you. I mean, that's what people doing gamification should first try to understand: what are the hopes and dreams of these people, and how can I create, you know, how can I use game mechanics to make it easier for them to actually achieve this or get better in the ways they're hoping to get better?
Yeah. I think one thing, you know, in chapter 2, you talk about in the sense of potential allies and how having a gameful mindset, whether it's, you know, mirroring other people or other elements that can make us feel closer to others. Elaborate more on what some of the biggest principles are in terms of how a gameful mindset can make us feel, you know, closer to the people we care about or make new friendships and relationships.
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, let's just talk about playing video games together. We know from many studies that if you play a video game with someone in the same room as them, that you start to mirror each other in a whole range of mind and body ways. Your heart rates will start to sync up. So your heart's beating at the same rhythm. Your breathing rate syncs up. So you're inhaling and exhaling in the same rhythm. Your facial expressions and posture will start to mirror each other. And then the kind of most interesting of all is the blood flow patterns in your brain start to mirror each other. So the same kind of neural networks are being activated. The same regions of the brain are getting more blood flow. And all of these changes, the heart rate, the breathing, the body language and the facial expressions and the mirror neuron effect, all of these changes are associated with liking someone more, feeling more empathy and compassion for them, being more willing to help them or ask them for help in the future, saying that you feel closer and you trust each other more. So it's very good that this happens when you play video games. And of course, scientists are interested in why this happens in video games. And it's been shown to happen more in video games than just other ways of spending time together, like watching TV together or even playing a card game together or having a conversation. The reason why the effect is so prominent in video games is that when you're playing a game together, whether it's cooperative or competitive, you have to get inside the other person's brain, right? If it's competitive, you're trying to figure out what they're going to do next so you can stay one step ahead of them. And if it's cooperative, you have to coordinate all of your efforts and decisions. So you're constantly trying to get in their brain and figure out what they're thinking so that you can work together effectively. And in video games, this happens at such a fast pace. You're making, you know, you could be making a dozen decisions every single minute about, you know, resource allocation or navigation, or you're just constantly making decisions in these fast-paced game environments. So you are working extra hard to mirror each other's mindsets. So this is amazing.
Does this explain the success of Twitch?
So this is really interesting. Because I've been digging into this research a lot to try to figure out, you know, what is Twitch or now YouTube gaming going to do for the gaming community, and what will it do to us if we are now watching people play instead of playing? Because one of the biggest findings in the game literature is that you have to actually play the game yourself to get the benefits. You can't watch someone else play. So on the face of it, you would think, oh, God, Twitch, YouTube gaming, no, people are going to stop actually benefiting from games. But if you look at the research on mirror neurons, it has not been done on video games, but it's been done on musicians playing instruments. A musician who knows how to play an instrument, for example, piano, watching someone else play the piano will have a strong mirror neuron effect with them. So their brain will go through all of the same, you know, blood flow patterns and activations as if they were at that piano trying to play that song themselves. And the better a piano player they are, the more they will perfectly mirror the actual musician. If you don't know how to play piano and you sit and watch someone else play the piano, you got nothing, because your brain can't simulate something it doesn't already know how to do. So my advice is to watch people play games that you know how to play. If you are interested in having any mental or social benefits, now you'll have the mental benefits of having activated a lot of the same regions of the brain so that you are developing the same kind of, you know, skills and abilities. You will have a social benefit in that you will feel closer to the person who's playing the game. They will not feel closer to you because they can't see your face. But if you can see their face, you will feel closer to them. So actually, I would think, I mean, that's if you're watching someone else. If I wanted a lot of allies, I would start streaming a game, you know, that lots of people know how to play, so that everybody who watched me play would feel like they want to help me in the future. That's my Machiavellian strategy there.
And it's interesting because a lot of people are really perplexed by the success of Twitch. They're like, you know, how do other, you know, millions of people want to watch other people play video games? And, you know, people are trying to replicate that, you know, that idea across different verticals or different, you know, different other categories. Maybe they'll want to watch other people do other stuff, but, you know.
Yeah, and we should, I mean, if you want to explain the phenomenon, I mean, I just look at benefits. That's what I look at. I mean, I don't think the benefits explain why it's so popular. It might explain, you know, 5% of it. But the real popularity is that we can learn from watching other people play. We can be entertained by the mistakes that they make, or we can be improved by, you know, learning from the strategies. And we also just like watching virtuosos, whether it's in athletics or in music. you know, we go to watch other people perform and we enjoy it. And you think about like the, you know, League of Legends playoffs, that is as virtuoso a performance as, you know, the Super Bowl or, you know, watching an opera. So, I mean, that's great. If you understand the game, then it's you're watching an amazing performance. If you don't understand the game, it doesn't make any sense to you. You can't see why they're so talented and skillful and how great the strategy is. Then, of course, you're not going to understand the phenomenon.
How about other gameful mindset approaches in whether friendships or relationships?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so there's also just a way to groom your social networks where you are constantly kind of reminding each other, hey, I'm here for you. Think of me if you have a problem, or, you know, I might think of you if I need someone. And social network games are actually set up really well for this kind of grooming of your relationships. There have been multiple studies showing that if you somewhat consistently play a game, could be Words with Friends, it could be Candy Crush Saga, that you will be more likely to have conversations with these people about non-gaming topics. So you interact with them conversationally more. You're more likely to see them in real life, to spend time together, you know, away from the game. And you're more likely to offer or receive social support about a real life problem. There are three elements to social games that underlie that phenomenon. It's the same three elements if you want to improve any relationship. Games just happen to be an effective way to do it. One is just increasing the frequency of interaction. That is important for developing that kind of social resilience. You need multiple interactions with somebody to build that up. You need there to be common ground. So something that you have shared together, you need to have a common experience or a common set of ideas, and so that playing the same game gives you something concrete that you're actually sharing. And then reciprocity, which is when you do someone a favor and they do you one back, and something as simple as sending somebody extra lives or extra moves, which I do with my in-laws all the time in Candy Crush Saga. I feel like I'm definitely improving my relationship with them every time I send them extra moves. And it's just a way of reminding people that you are somebody that they can get help from and that they could help you.
Yeah. And for people who are looking to make, you know, experiences or gamified elements that they make, you bring out the best in people, what are some other things that the best game designers understand about human behavior that normal people don't and can learn from?
Wow. Well, that's a big question. You know, I think for me, allowing people to choose their own, what I call epic wins, or work towards their own positive outcomes is really important. When you're designing a game, you need to be thinking about what the outcome is. And it has to be something that is relevant to people's real values or their sort of their core goals in life. And it should not be abstract values like winning, being the highest on the leaderboard, accumulating the most stuff, but real principles. You know, I worked with a company called PHD, which is a worldwide media purchasing company. And they wanted to do gamification internally. And so they set up this really cool system called Source. If you kind of Google it, you can see their case studies. They gave people points and for doing different things, helping people in the company. But what was really impressive about it was that, you know, what you were competing for was really authentic to people's goals. If you were helping other people in the company, you would be invited to participate in real career opportunities that were meaningful to you. So, you know, there'd be like this is a worldwide organization. There might be some guy in Germany who has been collaborating on tasks with people in London, and he's been really helpful and really excited about their work. And so they just bring him to London for 6 months so that he can actually work with them in person. They use the game mechanics to really investigate who are people who might benefit from working together? What are people interested in? And they're paying it off not with some abstract principle, you win, congratulations, you're better than everybody else. They pay it off with an actual career advancement, which is how it should be. It should be an actual outcome that will be meaningful in the real life of the participant. Every game that I've ever designed is geared towards, you know, you are now a published author. You are now certified by the World Bank as a social innovator, and they give you a mentor to help you with your social enterprise. I mean, I always try to have a real outcome that is going to make people better.
It's fascinating because if you look at, if we analyze Facebook or Instagram as a game, I don't even know if we can do that, but just for the sake of the argument, there, you know, obviously there's so many amazing things that they, you know, both do and are on net great things, but some people complain that when they, you know, see other photos, they get envious. Is that something that's built into the design of the game itself, or is that just something on their end, or how do you think about this?
I mean, I don't think about Instagram or Facebook as a game at all. I mean, this is like a disease. People try to explain the success of everything by looking for a game mechanic, but that's really not, it's not always appropriate. I mean, just because something has a feedback system or a counter that goes up, doesn't make it a game. I mean, and that maybe that's really the problem that we're looking at. So like social comparison, you feel bad because your photo only got 50 likes and my photo got 1,000 likes. That is a terrible thing. And you may motivate certain kinds of users to be more active because they really want to win or be the best. But most people do not play games to be the best. Most people are not the best at games they play. I'm not the best at any game that I play. I'm the worst at, you know, many games that I play. A counter would just make me less motivated to engage. My point is social comparison is actually terrible for many users and does make them depressed and anxious and use the system in ways that it's not meant to be. And other users will use it in ways that mean to exploit it. So if you're going to have any kind of a scoring system, you had better be prepared to have it exploited and also make people feel bad. So I'm not really into that. That, you know, if you look at the scoring system we have in the Superbetter app, there's no way to know what anybody else's score is. There's no social comparison, which is as it should be, because if you're depressed and I'm, you know, trying to find a job and my sister's, you know, trying to deal with being a new mom, I mean, why should we be comparing our scores? It's stupid and not helpful at all. But you do have a score, and the score measures how engaged you are with four areas of resilience: mental, emotional, physical, and social. And one of the things we learned from our players is that they wanted their score to go down when they weren't engaging enough with certain elements. They weren't battling bad guys. They weren't activating power-ups. They weren't connecting with their allies. They wanted their score to actually go down because it better reflected reality. And they didn't want it to be like some cheerful Pollyanna, I'm always making progress, you know, I'm always accumulating points. So we actually created a two-tier scoring system where you always see your highest score ever, and then you see your current score, which may be lower than your kind of peak resilience because you haven't activated any power-ups for 72 hours. So your emotional resilience is going to be low, and it will not go back up until you start activating power-ups. So, but it's not, that's, you know, that's the kind of feedback system that's helpful for a user. Oh, my emotional resilience is low, I should activate power-ups. It's meant, scores originally, you know, are meant to provide useful feedback, not for people to compare against each other's performance.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned in a previous interview how you play once a week, I believe, tennis with your husband, you lose, and you enjoy. You get it. And for an audience, you know, startups, we lose all the time. Talk a little bit more about the philosophy behind that.
Yeah, I mean, my husband is tall. He's 6'3". He's very athletic, and I am short. And also a very athletic, but, you know, a short and a woman. And so I play tennis against him once a week, and he beats me. Usually I can squeak out like 6-1, 6-1, maybe 6-0, 6-1. I mean, I'll win like one game or two games. And I love it because there's something really powerful and beneficial about being willing to lose terribly and consistently, but still getting better. I mean, I'm getting better. It just so happens that I'm playing against the same person. He's getting better every time we play too. So every time I'm getting better, he's still getting better and still massively better than me. But from a psychological standpoint, the willingness to keep trying hard because you genuinely enjoy an activity or genuinely want to get better, even if it means losing or feeling embarrassed or any of those things, that's something we should all practice more of. And for me, I do it with tennis.
Yeah. What are some games on console and computer or elsewhere that, you know, founders who go through these highs and lows, you know, besides reading the book, obviously, and playing Super Better, should be playing if they want to get into games or play, you know, games that are conducive to them?
Well, I mean, I always say the games you should be playing are the games that are most popular now because, there are games you should play for specific reasons, like Tetris or, you know, Words with Friends, if you're trying to achieve particular goals. But I think just generally, in order to have a kind of social and emotional intelligence about games, you should be playing what other people are playing. And so, you know, if you've never played League of Legends, you should play it and you should see what it entails and you should see what the interface looks like. You should try Minecraft because I think almost a billion people have played that game. You should be looking at Clash of Clans, you know, that's a really popular social game right now that hundreds of millions of people are playing. You should even look at the Kim Kardashian game to try to figure out why that game was so engaging to so many people. That's always my prescription. You know, if you don't know what game to play, go look at, you know, what's top ranked on Steam or what people are talking about on YouTube and give that game a shot so that you will have more social and emotional intelligence about what is engaging people, what is reaching and connecting to people.
Cool. Awesome. Well, the book is Super Better. Jane, where can people find you online and learn more about Super Better? And if you haven't asked for the Product Hunt audience, please let us know too.
Sure. Well, I'm on Twitter. I'm Avant Game. You can just Google my name, Jane McGonigal. And superbetter.com is where you can play online for free. You can also get the app for Android and iOS. My ask is for people to do at least, you know, one experiment in their own lives with a game, you know, to try one of these techniques and talk to other people about whether it works or not, because I want to create more conversation and more awareness about, you know, whether it's for depression, anxiety, controlling your cravings, increasing your energy, your willpower. I mean, people should have conversations about how they're strategically using games, because it's the kind of thing that almost anyone can benefit from. With 1.23 billion people playing games an hour a day, we should be having more conversations about how they help and fewer conversations about you know, why they're so bad for us.
No, yeah, that is a great note to end on. And especially, you know, as people are building products and in their personal lives, games can obviously have a big impact. So the book is Super Better. It will definitely be on Product Hunt. And Jane, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Eric. This is a lot of fun.